Hey y'all, welcome back to the Toxic Mom Podcast. This is episode 3, and this will feature Kalia McNabb. I just want to give you guys a warning. This might be a little too much for certain people. I don't want to upset anybody, so I just want to give you that disclosure prior to you listening to this. I hope you'll stick with me, but I understand if you need to exit stage right once we really get into it. I encourage you guys to follow me on Instagram at Toxic Mom Podcast, and of course, always send me your feedback at thetoxicmompodcast@gmail.com. So let's get into baby girl Kalia. Kalia McNabb was born on September 23rd, 2017, to Courtney Bell and Christopher McNabb. For this podcast, I'll refer to mom as Courtney and dad as McNabb. She was 5 pounds at birth and had to stay in the hospital an extra 2 days, which is not unusual for children born at 5 pounds. The medical staff just wants to make sure prior to discharge everything's okay. So they kept her 2 extra days. Mom was apparently discharged on the 25th of September, and 2 days later, Kalia was discharged. Mom and dad also have a toddler. I'm not going to disclose her name. It's really not relevant for this podcast, but just know that. So this is now their second baby. So back to September 27th, 2017, she's discharged. Mom and dad came and got her. On October 1st, 2017, Courtney drops off her newborn and the toddler to a cousin's house who doesn't live too far from her. And she goes about her business. On October 3rd, after 2 days of having the children, the cousin gives the children to Courtney's father. His name is Tim. And he keeps the children until October 6th. On October 6th, 2017, he returns the children to Courtney and McNabb. And the following day, on October 7th, Kalia is reported missing by mom. Mom wakes up, dials 911 around 10:30, and she reports that she woke up and her baby girl was missing. Her toddler was still there. However, Kalia was not. McNabb goes out to look for the toddler. So he was not there when the police arrived. When the police arrive, they are wearing body cameras. There is clear visual of mom and the toddler and the trailer park. They live in a trailer park. And mom has a cigarette in her hand. At times she's frantic and she's panicking looking for her infant. The house appears to be messy. There's clothes everywhere. There's toys everywhere. It's not clean. You can tell that. At one point, one of the police officers does, you know, make a statement when mom takes him into the bedroom to show where Kalia was sleeping. There's a lot of stuff on the bed, and he does ask about that. So there's, you know, that's give you like a little visual as to what's going on here and how they're living. So mom states that she went to sleep around 5:30 a.m. She put her newborn in the bassinet, and she goes to sleep in the living room. So this is a trailer, it's not too big. So she's in the living room and her daughter and the toddler are both sleeping in the back room. She wakes up around 10:30, her toddler wakes her up, and she goes into the back and checks, and Kalia is gone. She tells the police that her, McNabb, and the 2 children who live there, they of course asked where he was, and she states that he was out looking for her. He does come back, you know, and at this time there are family and friends starting to arrive. So a lot of people are now on the scene of this incident. Courtney and McNabb do go down to the police station and are asked questions in regards to this, and they both sort of stick to the same story that they went to sleep, they woke up, and she was gone. However, Dad has a little bit of a different version of it. He states he and Courtney did go to sleep after changing the infant's diaper, and they go to the living room and go to bed. He gets a text message from his father. He really doesn't go into what that message was. And he goes and checks on his two kids and they're sleeping. He falls back to sleep around 9:30, and he is obviously then waking up at 10:30 to find his newborn missing. So on October 8th, Kalia's body is found in the woods underneath a log, not too far from her trailer that she was living in. She is found in a drawstring bag. She has a onesie on, a diaper, and her body, in particular her head, is wrapped in a quote-unquote wife beater. Her body is taken to the medical examiner's office. There is an autopsy that is done, and her cause of death is listed as blunt force trauma to the head. The trauma was so brutal that it was irreversible, so there was no way that she would have been able to survive this. So newborns have open skulls. Their skulls are not completely closed at birth. And this is how a newborn is able to go out of mom's birth canal if they're having a natural delivery. And this is why a lot of babies that are born out of a birth canal, as opposed to a cesarean section, do have cone heads. Their skulls aren't fully closed till they're about 18 months old. So very fragile, you know, and so this was a pretty sad way that her little journey ended. So on October 8th, the same day that the baby went missing, the same day that the baby was found, the parents are obviously alerted that they found her body and she's dead, and friends and family are also notified as well. So a very, very sad ending to Kalia McNabb's life. So what do we always do with these podcasts? Let's peel off the layers, because there's never a case that is cut and dry. So let's start peeling these layers. For starters, mom and dad are reportedly first cousins. Courtney's biological mother, who really didn't raise her, she was raised by her father, Tim. He, the one that had the kids from October 3rd to October 6th, stated that McNabb is the nephew of Courtney's biological mother, so that's how they are first cousins. They also have a very heavy addiction to meth. And meth is a very, very potent drug. It's a highly addictive drug. It leaves people paranoid. They're awake often for days. And when they crash, quote unquote crash, they crash hard and they sleep a long time. And they're very, very hard to wake up. So these two parents have a heavy addiction to meth, according to both of them. This wasn't something that they kept secret. This was something that came out. Okay, so on October 8th, the same day that Kalia is found, McNabb was with a friend at the time, and they were driving, and they get alerted that her body was found in the woods. And when the friend comes to a red light at a traffic intersection, McNabb jumps out her car and flees. This particular day, back in, Khalil's from Covington, Georgia. So this particular day back in Georgia, it was pouring down rain. And he jumps out. He flees. He ends up in a convenience store. He comes in there. He's soaking wet. He's frantic. And he's yelling, I didn't do this. They're going to accuse me. They're going to pin it on me. And the woman that's working at the convenience store calls 911 and says there's, you know, a crazy man in here screaming. And they do arrest McNabb. And they bring him back down to the station. So, you know, now, you know, they want to know, you know, what's going on here. Spidey senses are going up with these detectives. On October 11th, 2017, McNabb was charged with malice murder, felony murder, aggravated battery, and concealing a death. All in relation to his newborn child's disappearance and death. On January 7th, 2018, Courtney was arrested and charged with second-degree murder, second-degree cruelty to children, and contributing to the deprivation of a minor. Rumor has it that they had to look for her. She was indicted early January. She obviously may have got wind of this and she took off, or maybe she took off because she was on a drug binge. Who knows? But that's the timeline. Infant born on September 23rd, found deceased on October 8th. Father is charged with her murder October 11th. Mother is then charged on January 7th. They have a joint trial that starts in May of 2019. Testimony from that trial included the investigators, police, 911 dispatchers, medical examiner, and friends and family. You know, the typical people that, you know, come to court during these type of trials. The trial can be viewed on YouTube. I did start watching it on YouTube a couple months ago, and I found footage to be a little difficult to listen to. So I did switch over and watch the majority of it on Court TV. The only thing about Court TV, there's no descriptions as to, you know, like in YouTube, you can read like a whole disclaimer about what's going on. So I like to read that, but it was a little hard for me to hear on YouTube. So if you go on YouTube, you can find it. You just type in Khalia McNabb, C-A-L-I-Y-A-H, McNabb, M-C-N-A-B-B. Or you can type in Courtney Bell or Christopher McNabb and it'll come up. And the same thing with Court TV. I type in McNabb in the search tool and it comes right up. So the trial on Court TV is in a chronological order. The trial, unfortunately, on YouTube is not, but you can kind of pick which you want to hear. So you can go on and look at that. Okay, so some of the people that stood out to me at the trial, I'm not going to go into testimony from every single person because it's not necessary, and some of it to me was filler, but this is what attorneys do. They have to make a case strong. The burden of proof is on the prosecutor, so they have to prove reasonable doubt. So they have to prove more so than the defense attorney. So there was a lot of testimony. The people that stood out to me were Courtney's cousin, who had the children for 2 days, her father, who had the children for 2.5 days, her aunt, who testified, the mother of the cousin, and who is also Courtney's aunt. I'll just say that. That might have confused you. Courtney's aunt testified, as well as one of the investigators that analyzed the messaging between Courtney and McNabb, and also between McNabb and another person. So those people stood out to me. There were some others that came in and sort of, you know, put a lot of the pieces together, but you can kind of, from what I'll discuss with you, you can start formulating in your mind exactly what went on here. So we'll start with the cousin. Courtney's cousin testified in open court that she did obtain custody of the children on October 1st. Courtney dropped the toddler and the newborn off. And this cousin also has four children of her own who live with her and a girlfriend. The cousin doesn't live too far. She stated it was in walking distance, so there was no driving. Courtney does have a car. She has a car that her father gave her or purchased for her, so that's how she does get around. But keep in mind, neither one of them, Courtney nor McNabb, have active employment. So that's important as well. Courtney drops the kids off. The cousin keeps them for 2 days. She stated that Courtney was responsive to her, you know, checking on the kids here and there, but that was really pretty much all it was. The cousin then becomes very overwhelmed, according to her, and she calls her mother, Courtney's aunt, and, you know, says, I have Courtney's kids on top of my own, and newborns are a lot of work. You know, they're on a liquid diet, they're eating every couple hours, if that, some of them eat every hour, so it's a lot. There's no sleep, really, with them, you know, and she has older kids. I think her youngest at the time, that she said, was 7, so she's used to, a reasonable amount of sleep. But now she has this, you know, infant, and, you know, they're a lot. So she became overwhelmed. She does contact Courtney's aunt, and Courtney's aunt also testifies to this, that her daughter called her and said, you know, she was very overwhelmed. And then that aunt then contacts her brother, who is Courtney's dad, the grandfather of the children, and he comes over and he gets them on October 3rd. Upon his arrival, however, he's upset, which he has every right to be, because he more than likely is probably not surprised here that this is going on. He has a daughter and her spouse are heavily addicted to drugs, and, you know, addiction comes first before anything. So this is unfortunately more than likely not his first time at the rodeo with having to go pick up, you know, the kids. Probably prior to this, he was probably getting the other granddaughter a lot, which he did state, you know, in court that he's the one that foots the bill for everything. He's the one that buys the clothes, buys the food, buys the milk, pays bills a lot. You know, so it's a lot on him. So he has every right to be upset. Somehow he makes contact with his daughter and McNabb. He goes over, he confronts McNabb, apparently runs off. Courtney's upset. Courtney threatens to call the police on him and report him for kidnapping. And we'll go back to the car. The car apparently was purchased by Dad. Dad takes the car, you know, and he states that he took it because they weren't doing the right thing here. They didn't need a car, in his opinion. So he takes the car and the kids, and he goes to his home, and he houses them for 3 days. Prior to bringing them back, he does tell Courtney that she needs to get her act together. She needs to clean up the trailer. And so I'm assuming she does do that, because he does give custody of the children back to her and McNabb on October 6th. Courtney calls the police again on her father. She does report that she feels he's kidnapping them. The police respond. The police officer on the stand does state that he was not able to do much because he told Courtney that this was a civil matter. And he does make note that when he comes there, he notices that she has a black eye. And if you are able to watch any of the footage of this online, you will see on October 7th when the police arrived to the home to get information on her disappearance, Mom does have a black eye, and I believe it's her left eye. He asks her about this, and she does not really say anything. And again, he lets them know that this is a civil matter. He does obtain, you know, do you feel safe with your father having the children? And she says yes. So he pretty much leaves. But again, she's adamant with she wants this car. He can keep the kids as long as she gets the car. And the 911 dispatcher that took this phone call, they brought her in to testify, and they played the tape back, asked her a few questions, and you can hear her on 911 talking about this car. So it's pretty interesting, her state of mind with that. So then the next day, Kalia unfortunately is missing. So Mom and Dad have two different versions of what happened when they woke up. Dad is alleging that, okay, they did go to sleep around 5:30 in the morning, but Dad got a text message from his father that woke him up at 9:30 on October 7th, and he responded to that message, and he goes and checks on the children, and then he falls back to sleep, and then he's awakened at 10:30 by their infant, or excuse me, not their infant, by their toddler. Mom, on the other hand, slept straight through, didn't get up when a text message came through to his phone. She slept straight through. So that's a little bit of a different tweak added. So that's an interesting thing that was noted there. So the next person that I thought was interesting with this case was the investigator that analyzed the Facebook messages. The two of them are communicating via Facebook. I don't think they had active cell phone plans, because I would assume that you're going to just regularly text somebody or call them, but they were doing all their messaging through Facebook back and forth to one another. So around the time that the cousin and dad or grandfather had the two children, there was a lot of correspondence between Courtney and McNabb. He seemed like he was out and about all the time with his friends, doing drugs, really not home, worrying about Courtney. And she's upset about this. And, you know, before the third, when the father takes the car, there's talk between the two of them of going back and trying to get the car from Dad. But the way that he had the car on his property, it was going to be impossible for them to get. There's talk of them, about the two of them, they're trying to find rides to go get their drugs. Courtney brings up rent being due coming up, and he says, I don't have any money. So they're trying to figure out how they're going to pay rent, how they're going to make bills. At one point, Courtney does say, hey, you know, you need to come home, help me clean up this trailer so we can get our kids back. But again, McNabb doesn't really seem too interested. There's a couple of I love yous here and there, but it's a lot of arguing between the two of them going on between October 1st and October 6th when they do not have their children at all. The cousin that initially took them did state that she knew that there was a lot of drug use going on at their home, as well as grandfather. So she felt like the children were not in a safe place with them, as well as the grandfather also stated this. So, you know, this is, are you guys starting to get the bigger picture as to what's going on here? This is not normal behavior for two parents. I mean, they're young, but this is not normal behavior. It's not normal for you to, after having your child for 3 or 4 days, to just go drop them off for almost a week and really a here and there message, how are they? And then you're calling the cops on your father when he expresses his frustration and anger, and it seems like the only thing you're worried about is the car. So, you know, it's It's very sad what's going on here with these two children. Obviously very, very tragic for Kalia. One thing that jumped out to the investigators was that McNabb was apparently out looking in the woods for Kalia. And he did say that to the detectives at the beginning stages of the investigation before they even found her. So that was a red flag for quite a few people. Why would he be looking in the woods? And apparently he was looking in the woods around the same area where she was found. There was a friend that he was communicating with on Facebook around this time. She did testify and confirm that she was messaging him here and there. And at one point, she did get blocked from his page. I didn't really find her testimony too, well, it was relevant, but it wasn't something like, oh, wow. Like, this is not unusual behavior. And when you're dealing with people that have a drug addiction and they're searching for drugs and there's no money, there's a lot of people that they surround themselves with so they can get their drugs. So this girl was brought in and she was currently incarcerated for possession of methamphetamine. She just testified that there was messages going on between her and McNabb, and you know, at one point there might have been talk of him and her hooking up on maybe like a romantic level. So Courtney apparently did find out about this. So she was brought in. There was another friend brought in. He was a gentleman. I found him credible, but his testimony was he saw the baby the night before and said she was, quote, sleeping good. And that mom and dad were smoking meth with him the night before, but it was in the trailer. And when he left, the baby was still alive. So he was brought in to testify to that. He seemed very nervous on the stand, and he seemed very upset at what was going on. So he was brought in as well. The person that stood out to me as far as their friends was a gentleman named Shane Kidd. Shane Kidd was mentioned by Courtney the day she got arrested. She made reference that she felt like the baby was kidnapped, that somebody came in and kidnapped the baby. And the detectives and all just weren't buying it, because when she was talking to the investigator at her arrest, he asked her, what would somebody have to gain out of kidnapping your baby? You guys didn't have anything. You didn't have jobs. You didn't have anything. And she agreed with that. But she said she heard lots of stories. And one that stood out to her was the friend of him and her. His name was Shane Kidd. She heard that he kidnapped the baby and killed her, but she wasn't quite sure because he has two kids of his own. And, you know, I honestly didn't think that there was a kidnapping here, to be honest with you. But his name was brought up. So he did come and he testified, and he threw a monkey wrench into McNabb's timeline. He threw a really big monkey wrench into the timeline. So if you remember, McNabb said that he woke up at 9:30 from a text from his dad, went back to sleep, and woke up at 10:30. The friend is completely debunking that story. Shane said that he received a Facebook message from McNabb at 7:41 a.m. on the morning that Kalia went missing. McNabb stated he was wigging and tripping and needed to get out of there. He was paranoid. He needed to get some drugs. Then he says an hour later, McNabb texted him at 8:40 that the baby was missing. And the interesting part about those messages, there was no proof presented in court that they even existed. So if there's no proof that they were there, to me, they didn't exist. I think the story behind this guy is he heard his name floating around, and it's really never good when your name is being linked to being a child killer. So I think Shane was angry that he heard his name being thrown out there. Who started the rumor? They don't know. According to mom, she said she heard it from a friend who said Shane directly said, you know, he did this. And then at one point she says, you know, something else. So there's a lot here surrounding this guy, but I don't think the detective was really sold on that. He himself, Shane Kidd, went in allegedly to the police station 2 weeks after McNabb was arrested and made these statements that, hey, he texted me at 7:30 or 7:40 that he was wigging and tripping. So he wasn't really asleep. That's what he was trying to say. So whether the jury believed that, I don't know. Be pretty interesting to hear from them if they ever speak out. I would love to hear what they thought about Shane Kidd's testimony. And also, he has a history of lying to the police, lying on the stand, apparently. But he claims that all that was to try to, quote unquote, save himself during his own cases. It wasn't to try to pin something on someone else. So I didn't find him too credible because of, you know, it just seemed a little odd. There's no proof of these messages. You just randomly walk in the police station 2 weeks later after your friend's arrest and you say, hey, you know, it was very odd. They also played some messages between Courtney and McNabb when he was corresponding with her from jail. He made a phone call to her in October and then again in December. She was very angry and hostile towards him. He's talking about how he did not do this. How could she even think that? She's saying, you know, there's a lot going on here. There's a lot I'm hearing. I don't know who to believe. Then she brings up the fact that, you know, you're text messaging other women. And then she brought up Shane Kidd, and he said that this is all a lie. He absolutely did not text message him at the time he said. So, you know, he's upset. You know, he's sitting in jail. Around the time of the second phone call, he's a little bit more clear-headed because now he's been in jail for 2 months and he's had time to clean up. Obviously, he's not doing meth in jail, so I'm pretty sure from what I've heard, when people go in to jail and they're heavily addicted to drugs, they do have to detox them out. So by this time in the December phone call, he's very calm in the phone call. He's very calm. You know, he's telling Courtney, I love you, I can never do this. And Courtney's still very hostile and yelling at him. And she's trying to figure out, you know, what's going on. So that was the basis of their trial. Trying to figure out, this trial was a big whodunit. You know, did McNabb wake up at 9th after, you know, his father texted him? Did he do something to Kalia at that time? Who knows? Did something happen to Kalia prior to them even reporting her missing? Did mom or dad wake up and maybe she was crying and they couldn't handle it and they struck her? There is evidence that Chris McNabb was physically abusive towards Courtney. Testimony from friends and family on the stand did reveal this. Courtney also told a detective this at her arrest, that he did hit her during the pregnancy, after the pregnancy. was there a big fight and he picked up the baby and did something? Who knows? Or did mom do it? There's a lot of people that think mom may have done it because she was angry at the fact that he was constantly leaving, and there's messages of him with other women. You know, did she have some postpartum depression on top of her drug use? Did she get overwhelmed? Did Kalia wake up and she was trying to sleep after being awake for all these days? Did she do something to this baby? Nobody knows. It's to me, this is a classic case of whodunit, and it's only two suspects here. There was, McNabb did state that other people had access to his home because the door was always unlocked. And I believe that. I believe that they did leave their door unlocked. These are two meth addicts. There's a lot of activity going on in their home. The cousin testified to that. The father, the aunt, one of the friends that took the stand said, you know, they were in there the night before Kalia went missing smoking. You know, there's a lot going on here. There's a lot of commotion going on in this trailer park. There's a lot. So who really did kill Kalia? She didn't end up in the woods by herself. She didn't give herself that head injury. So clearly somebody did this to her. And it was either Christopher McNabb or Courtney Bell. Once the trial ended, you know, the jury heard closing arguments from both sides. They did convict mom and dad. They found them guilty on all charges. McNabb, since he had more complex charges, more serious charges, he was convicted and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. The judge did allow him to speak and prior to sentencing, and he said he did not do it. He was innocent. And, you know, the judge said, well, what sentence would you give someone who did this? And Christopher McNabb says they should be put under the jail. And the judge agreed and gave him a life sentence without parole. So he's never getting out. One thing I want to mention that I thought was interesting that I missed was while he was in jail, he did get evaluated by a forensic psychologist. And she was one of the last people to take the stand at this trial. And she brought up something that I thought was pretty significant. She says she noticed that during her interview with him, he was masturbating. And he brought this up at his sentencing. He completely denied that. And I thought that was very interesting that he brought that up during his sentencing. So again, I just wanted to put that out there. That was very telling to me as well. I sort of forgot about it because she really wasn't up there too long on the stand. So back to the sentencing. So he got life without parole. Mom got 30 years, 15 to be served in confinement, and 15... she could possibly serve on probation. The two of them have filed for new trials for ineffective assistance of counsel. McNabb was upset that his family history was brought into this. He felt like the jury did not need to know that they were first cousins. He felt that that made the jury biased towards him. He also said that his drug addiction should not have been brought up and that there was no hardcore concrete evidence that he killed his child. Courtney also filed for similar things, that there was no hard court evidence linking her, that she should not have been charged because they already charged him with this. If you watch the trial, both of their lawyers don't object to too much stuff going on here. There's not a lot of objections from either of their attorneys. So will they get new trials? Don't know. That remains to be seen. One other thing that jumped out with her motion for a new trial was that she wants this time access to cosmetic advances. She didn't feel like she had access to that prior to the trial and during the trial. So did she feel like she was entitled to having makeup on, her hair styled in a different way? Did she not like the way her clothes looked? Because she looked presentable in court, as did he. He had on a suit. She had on, a blazer with some, outfits. I don't know what she is alleging here, but that's part of her motion for a new trial. So at this point, they both remain in jail. And I just want to play something for you. At her sentencing, her lawyer spoke first, and then she spoke. And I want to play that for you because I thought this was extremely interesting content. So here you go. Check this out.
Your client wants to make any statements.
I didn't do this. Y'all know I didn't do this.
I had a conversation back.
We did.
Chambers on Wednesday, remember, morning? And at the time I told you there's a difference between the reality of the situation and what you think. I explained to you exactly why you were being charged with the crimes. What that you knew about the murder, what that you anticipated the murder, what that you planned the murder, any of those things. It was simply that you created an environment that caused your children to be put second, and Mr. McNabb to be put first. As the state said in their closing, they used the example of a rattlesnake being thrown into a room and the child being put into there. Well, your whole claim is, I took him back because I wanted to have a family. In that analogy, the state used, it's just kind of like saying, your child's dead from a rattlesnake bite. Why would you put it in there? And you responded, why? Just wanted her to enjoy nature, have an appreciation of the outdoors, without appreciating the danger. I'm sorry, but for you to go around chasing McNabb, doing meth, flies in the face of what any normal mother would do. We hear stories out in society, out everywhere. The mother bear, they're so ferocious. Why? Because you're messing with their child. All those kind of things. And you chose methamphetamine and McNabb over a baby.
It's a sickness, but I tried to be a good mama.
The problem, Ms. McNabb, is that, like most criminals, you have this version of what a good mama is that is so far from the norm that, you go anywhere in this county, talk to anybody who's watching this and say, is it a good mama who doesn't even care about her 14-year-old baby? Put them with a cousin. I've known of instances where mamas won't even let in the first couple of weeks of a child's life people around the child for fear that the child's immune system hadn't been built up and they don't want germs brought into the child. They go to that extent. You went just the exact opposite direction. And there's just no excuse for that. On count.
So, again, that was the Honorable John Ott, who presided over the case, giving his statement to Courtney at her sentencing. So this case remains to be seen if the two of them get new trials. It'll be very interesting if they do. I will definitely obviously have a follow-up for you guys as well. So, as I always ask you before I leave, is Courtney Bell a toxic mom? Send me your feedback, thetoxicmompodcast@gmail.com. We'll chat soon.